Okay, those of you that were here earlier, you saw the Paramount movie Fire in the Sky, where something extremely unusual occurred on November 5th, 1975, in a forested area of northern Arizona. So we've seen Hollywood's version. But now, in a few minutes, you will hear the stories that actually happened from the gentleman who lived through it and, to a certain extent, continues to live through it today. I remember I was speaking at UFO conferences following the publication of my book, Mexico's Roswell. And I happened to be at a UFO conference, the same one where Travis Walton was speaking. And I remember I was very busy getting my stuff ready, and I was scheduled to speak at some point. And I remember walking into the auditorium, and Travis had just begun speaking. I had never heard him before, and I was just transfixed. I actually stood there like a statue and listened. You know, probably insects could have gone in my open mouth. I was just amazed. Because one thing is to watch Hollywood's semi-fictionalized version of what happened, but another thing is to actually listen to the man himself tell you exactly what happened during the 5 days that he was aboard that craft and everything else associated with the story. So Travis has asked us to play a short little introductory video, and it's just about 12 minutes long. And after the video plays, he will be with us to talk about his personal experience.
You folks to meet the actors who portray Travis and Mike in the film. The other man I'm sure you'll recognize right off is perhaps best known for his hole in the head role opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 2. He's the cop who won't die, but melts and gets split apart, everything else. But he's here and he's in one piece. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome D.B. Sweeney and Robert Patrick.
I think they like you.
This is Sergeant Reynolds from Criminal Investigations calling Lieutenant Frank Waters. Are you there, Lieutenant? Over.
Because it is true. Truth is a little stranger than fiction, as they say. And this is a good, solid script. And I like the boys. The boys are good. You know, it's their picture, and I'm just kind of supporting them. But I like it.
To really relate to Travis and Mike, you and DB had to learn how to be loggers and...
Yeah, we were with the chainsaws out there logging, and I actually nearly took out a bunch of crew guys. I was supposed to aim it at the camera this way, and the lights and everything were here, and crew guys were here. This is a huge tree, and I had it going, and I thought I had it aimed the right way, and next thing I know, it's going towards all these guys, and they're all running, they're screaming at...
Can't hear you.
the whole energy of the cast came together pretty quickly. The first or second day we were in the room together, you could sort of look around, you know, oh, there's Craig Sheffer, yeah, he's Dallas, and Robert Patrick was already well into his thing, and it fell together very nicely.
Hey. Hey, bud.
We said we'd do a little fishing when the contract's over.
When this contract's over, yeah.
Come on, it's what we need, one of our camping trips. Some hunting, some fishing, chasing bears.
Oh, yeah, I remember. You ran that bear up that tree.
Just trying to make friends.
So how come you can't make friends with Dallas?
He's just jealous I can do something he can't.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Reading, right?
Oh, I just play a sheriff. Who is a real character, Sheriff Waters, and he doesn't believe a word they say. He just doesn't believe in UFOs, and also he's never had a case he didn't solve, and it really gets to him because he's going to have one he can't solve, and it really bothers him. He doesn't believe a word about any UFOs.
You expect me to believe that a flying saucer came down and took your friend away to outer space?
That's the truth, mister. That's exactly what happened.
Is it? Is it?
And you know that, Blake. Why the heck aren't you speaking up for us? Why are you letting this man talk to us like this?
David, I will.
It seems like you're not even trying to believe us. We all saw the thing. We all saw the guy get zapped.
How about you, Mr. Dallas? You go along with that?
Oh, yeah, I go along with that.
You don't sound too sure.
Well, I'm sure.
Why don't you fellas tell Lieutenant Waters what you saw? Or what you think you saw?
It was the house that saw first.
What about it?
Tell us about it. What'd you see? What did it look like?
It looked like a fire.
Stop, Mike! Stop the truck!
Travis!
Travis!
You son of a bitch!
What the hell are you doing? Get back in the truck, asshole!
Travis, whatever were you thinking about, boy?
Well, you'd have to know me back then.
What, a Hellraiser?
Yeah, well, you know, I can explain what he did. You know, about three months before this happened, we had another little experience. He jumped out of the truck to chase a bear that ran across the road. And if you can explain that, you can explain this.
I'm not like that anymore. It's just, you know, they're saying get back in the truck, and that was just kind of egging me on. I was scared too, but...
Yeah, it's an incredible experience playing these guys, I'll tell you.
Some of these loggers came back.
Mm-hmm.
One did not. You did not.
I played
your
Travis
character.
Walton.
Right.
I see the UFO, I get out of the truck, and just after what we just saw, I get zapped by a bolt of light, and I'm knocked unconscious. The other guys think I'm dead, and they take off. And then Mike realizes I've left my best friend there, I got to go back. And he comes back about 5 minutes later, and I'm gone without a trace.
The other loggers did not know what had happened.
No, actually, we're all in the truck just going home from a work day. And we see it. We all see it. He wants to get a closer look and walks out underneath it. So the other guys that are with us in the crew cab, they all see it as well.
Yeah.
So we have like six witnesses.
Right.
And then as DB said, I go back with the guys and we look for him. He's gone.
And in real life, this group went back and reported him missing,
yeah.
Maybe even dead.
Yeah, yeah. We knew he was missing. We thought he was dead. And we went back to the town and we explained to him what had happened. We knew that it was, it's a wild story, but we're sharing it with them, and they didn't want to hear it.
We've been telling you the truth since the beginning, and now we're ready to prove it. We'll take your damn lie detector test. You set it up. We'll be there. You go ahead. And if any of you got anything to say about me or my crew, you say it now. And you say it to my face.
Are you saying, Bill, that all seven of these people are lying?
I'm afraid we have to say that on the basis of physical evidence.
Meaning?
Physical evidence that should have been there, but was not. Now, you heard Travis and Mike Rogers claim that this beam from the UFO was like a grenade exploding, fire, flame, that Travis was knocked 10 feet back, and in his book he claims he hit his shoulder against the rock. When the morning after this incident allegedly occurred, when the law enforcement officers went to the site to inspect, they found all kinds of dry pine needles, which, if this had actually happened, those needles would have been blasted away, they would have caught fire, they would have burned.
Why are you laughing, Travis?
Well, because this is typical of the sort of reasoning pattern this man uses in attacking all UFO cases. He's equating the absence of evidence to be the evidence of absence. That's absurd, you know, and that's actually a logical fallacy.
It's necessary for people to know just exactly what Philip Klass really is, who he really is. He's nothing more than a disinformation specialist from Washington, D.C.
Well, what's the word?
The results of one of the tests. Unusual. It's inconclusive. We'll have to try again tomorrow.
What about the other ones? What's the word on them?
The process is still ongoing. We never discuss the results until all the testing is complete.
Sorry, fellas. Come back down here in the morning, 9:00 sharp.
No.
What?
I said no. Look, we did what we said we'd do. We came in here like guinea pigs and let you test us, but that's it. We've had enough.
I ain't coming back again.
You're saying that you're no longer willing to cooperate.
That's all we do is cooperate. And all we get back from you is grief.
Mike, we need a little bit of time.
No, Mike, I'm sick of this shit. You want to press charges? You go ahead. You do it now. We told you everything we know, and if that's not good enough, that's too damn bad, because that's all there is. Let's get the hell out of here.
What are you saying, son?
Well, Blake, my charts don't lie. You ask me, those boys are telling the truth.
I think we can be rather certain that this incident occurred, that they're not lying. What they claim happened did happen, and it's not a hoax.
The fact that I have to make the audience believe this extraordinary thing has actually happened to me, and if I can do that, it'll be a great victory for me, because it's not a matter of getting them to believe that your dog died or that your car won't start or that you broke up with your girlfriend. It's asking them to believe something quite extraordinary, you know, of biblical proportions. And that was what initially got my attention when I read the script, that central challenge of making, we're not making a special effects supernatural movie. We're making a movie about ordinary people where something extremely extraordinary happens.
You know, Robert, what about you? Are you an UFO believer, general?
Well, if I can believe I'm a Terminator, I think I can believe this. I've had the theory, I think that Carl Sagan said it best, that we'd have to at least, you know, we can't be that arrogant not to consider that there could be something else out there. So I came into it like that. And then after I met Mike and Travis and talked to them at length about what they had experienced, I totally believed their story.
You do?
Totally.
So you believe that there are creatures out there who are far advanced technologically over us and even come and visit time to time?
I believe that these guys went through a very traumatic experience. I believe what they've told me. And as I said, going into the movie, I've always had the idea that it is a small universe. And we are a tiny speck, so we have to at least be open-minded enough to consider the probability.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like everybody to give a warm South Texas welcome to a gentleman who went through a lot of airports and a lot of plane flights from northern Arizona to be with us today, Mr. Travis Walton.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. The movie really does leave us with the same kind of emotional impact that we went through back when we lived through all this. But as you, most of you probably know, Hollywood never sticks strictly to real life stories. I think it would really, you know, in all fairness to them, it would be very difficult to tell most real life stories exactly the way they really happen. You know, they're trying to do in 90 minutes something that took a number of years to happen. So it has its limitations, but at the same time, I think it did some good. It was the first time that Hollywood was willing to do a full-length movie about a real-life incident. And I think it really did open up people's minds in their willingness to take a look at the facts. And that was really my goal in agreeing to do the movie in the first place. It wasn't something that happened overnight. It took like 6 years with, you know, various studios looking like they were going to take it on and then not going forward with it. And but when we finally got the green light, you know, I still had misgivings about whether this was something I wanted or not, because, you know, I'd turned down a number of offers before talking to the Tracy Torme. But he was the first one that had done his homework, had, you know, thoroughly studied the case, talked to everybody involved, the sheriff, the other crew members. And he persuaded me that they weren't going to sensationalize it. And he did his best to keep that promise. But he's only the screenwriter. You know, once the director gets involved, he has a say. The producers have a say. The studio has a say. And each thing that signs on gains a little more power over the end product. So... right after the movie came out, a lot of people were very angry at me about the fictionalizations that happened in the movie. But, you know, I was powerless to affect that. When I saw things in the script that I, you know, didn't feel good about, I wrote some letters to the producers, and their reply was rather dismissive. You know, I realized I really didn't have any power to affect it at all. So I tried to make the most of it. And all in all, it was something that, you know, I'm glad happened. But still, looking for a remake that'll tell it more like it really happened. I don't expect it to ever be like a documentary. I understand that, you know, there are certain abbreviations that are necessary. Like in the movie, there's a character named Don. I mean, a character named Dan, who is really playing both of my brothers, Don and Dwayne. And so I don't want to get too much into going through point by point where the movie departed from what really happened. I'll just tell you how it was that day. The movie's got five of us out there. There was actually seven. And we just finished work. We'd been putting in some long days. We were trying to, you know, get as much done before the weather shut us out of the woods. And so we loaded our equipment into the truck and we're headed out of there. In the movie, it gives the impression we had, you know, been driving for some time and everybody's kind of dozing off. But we'd just recently been doing this vigorous physical exercise. We were all in a very alert state of mind. And the smokers were in the back seat and they were just lighting up and all these little conversations go on amongst the crew. We're driving down the road, bouncing along, everybody joking. And one by one, these little conversations started to go silent. So I assumed that, you know, they were catching sight of what caught my attention. I saw these little points of glimmers of light coming through the trees ahead. And it was definitely something out of the ordinary. This is, you know, a darkening forest and, you know, there's really not supposed to be anything there. But we had heard some shots in the distance and knew that it was deer hunting season. So that was my first explanation that came to mind, that, you know, maybe there were some deer hunters camped up there on the ridge. And but, you know, there was just something not right about that. We were going south, kind of uphill. There was this, we were paralleling the edge of this ridge, and the crest of the ridge was to our right. And so, you know, the light was coming from higher than where we were, but at the same time, it wasn't that, you know, it was higher than where the ground level would have been. So I thought, not campers, you know. And, you know, they probably wouldn't have thought that camping near a bunch of chainsaw noise would have been a good place to camp. So, you know, that didn't pan out. And since it was higher up, I was thinking about a crashed plane hanging up in a tree and found out that, you know, later that Dwayne Smith, one of the crewmen, was thinking along the same lines. But in the past, we had been driving to work and we would see a tree that had been hit by lightning, you know, with some flames still there, and we stopped and put the fire out. Because the Mogollon Rim area there in northern Arizona has the highest number of lightning strikes of any place in the continental United States, except for the Everglades. So we thought it might be a fire, and that's where the name Fire in the Sky came from. But the closer we got, the more that wasn't adding up, and all these little glimmers, and there was just something kind of odd about this glow. And so pretty soon, you know, the crew was saying, what's that, you know? And I said, Mike, hurry up, get up there, because, you know, you could see up ahead where there was a break in the trees and the light was sort of shining across the road. So, you know, that was where the clearing was. And when we got to where that little path of light was, bam, there it was. I yelled out, stop the truck, Mike. And about the same time, Alan in the back yelled out, it's a flying saucer, because there it was, unmistakable, less than 100 feet away, you know, probably closer than from here to the back of the room. And, you know, this is, some of the skeptics were saying, oh, those guys didn't see a UFO. They just saw the planet Jupiter off in the sky. That's the reason they passed light detector tests. But, you know, this was a clearly defined metallic disc, had glowing panels on it, and hovering there outlined against the sky, totally unmistakable. But as the truck stopped, I was just thinking it's going to take off. You know, many times we've been driving through the woods and we'll catch sight of an animal, and one of us will, and call out to the others, look, there's a bobcat or whatever. And before the others can even look, it's just gone. So that was kind of my impression with this UFO. I was just thinking when I got out of it, got out of the truck and headed towards it, that it would just be gone before I got that close. Now, later in an interview with Hard Copy, Alan Dallas said that it looked to him like I was just being drawn towards it, you know. And I took issue with that, but Steve Pearson, the youngest guy in the crew, said, no, I think you were in some kind of trance. But it didn't feel that way to me, you know. I just felt like I just wanted to see it up close before it got away. But, you know, and then other people argue, well, if they were controlling you, they would just make you think it was your idea. So whatever the case was, I just came towards it, wanting to see it. And then as I got closer, the sound it was making just, you know, it was a little scarier the closer I got. And there was this feeling. And, you know, Mike and some of the other crewmen said that it seemed like something was about to happen. And I'm thinking that what that caused that feeling was that there was a kind of like an electrical charge building up in the craft. Because when I got up close to it, the sound got louder and it started to move upward. So, you know, that kind of startled me. And I jumped down into a crouch, but the closest cover was this log that was sticking up out of this pile of debris, logging debris there. And I crouched down behind the log. And they kept yelling at me to get back in the truck and swearing at me, get out of there, get the hell out of there. And so, you know, I didn't really need to be told. I was already thinking that I'd gotten myself into a, you know, a dangerous situation there. So I decided to run back to the truck. So I raised up and turned to go. But right when I straightened up, bam, that's when it hit me. And let me get the slides going here. I almost forgot about those. But, you know, oh, don't tell me. I hit the wrong button. A little help here. I hit that bottom button you told me not to hit. Anyway. I just felt this shock go through my body, and it was just kind of a numbing sort of, it felt kind of like an electrical shock or like I'd physically been hit. And Dwayne Smith, one of the other crewmen, said, and he later became an electrician, so he said it sounded to him like high voltage. And in one of the police reports, one of the crewmen described it as looking like a long blue flame. But another crewman said it looked like a laser beam, you know, just a shaft of energy. And lightning bolt, you know, whatever their descriptions, it was just a really powerful blast. You know, they said it looked like I'd stepped on a landmine, like a grenade had gone off.